You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at SevillePodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at SevillePodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Regular listeners of our podcast might know Rick Britton. He's a Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer. An award-winning historian, Rick also organizes a Civil War and day trip series in conjunction with the Charlottesville Senior Center. On Wednesday, August 17, 2011, Rick Britton himself delivered a presentation entitled Saving Stonewall Jackson's Bacon, the Charlottesville Artillery at Port Republic. It's an interesting tale about an incident that took place on June 8, 1862, about how the Charlottesville artillerymen stood their guns and saved their army's baggage and ammunition trains from capture by an uncharacteristically aggressive federal cavalry force. This is part 5 of a 7-part series for 2011. Here's Rick Britton.
All right, let's do some orienteering first on the maps. So when we get into the action, you can follow what's happening. Let's look at this large map of primarily the Shenandoah Valley first. Notice the Blue Ridge Mountains running from the southwest to the northeast. Notice the Massanutten Mountain in the center. It runs for almost exactly 50 miles. It breaks up the Shenandoah Valley into the Main Valley to the west and the Luray or the Page Valley to the east. The North Fork of the Shenandoah flows through the Main Valley itself. The South Fork of the Shenandoah flows through the Luray or Page Valley. And you know, there's always this confusion of moving up and moving down the valley. The way to remember, the way that I've tried to train myself, and sometimes I don't always remember, is that the Shenandoah flows from the southwest to the northeast. So the up and down the valley is based on which way the water is going. So you go down the valley by going from the southwest to the northeast, because that's the direction the water is flowing. So that's going downhill, down the valley. As you go from Harper's Ferry to Stanton, you're going uphill, so you're going up the valley. Make sense? I know it's kind of counterintuitive, but you know, but that's the logic. That's the logic behind it. A couple of other important places to note. Charlottesville, I had to add, because the cartographer left out Charlottesville. That was really embarrassing. So it looked like there was nothing on the Orange and Alexandria or the Virginia Central between Gordonsville and Meacham River Station. They forgot to put in Charlottesville. So notice that I add Charlottesville. Notice the railroad going to Stanton. That's going to be important. Notice as you go west to Stanton, a sign that says to McDowell. We'll talk about that in just a few moments. Notice where the North River and the South River come together to form the South Fork of the Shenandoah, and that is at Port Republic. Do you see it? It's just below the southern face of the Massanutten. Now, I added in Cross Keys, because Cross Keys was also not on the map. So it's just a little bit to the northwest of Port Republic, just a few miles away, about 6 or 7 miles away. All right, then notice the Valley Turnpike. The Valley Turnpike by the Civil War had been macadamized for a while. It was actually paved, and that's why it's drawn in thicker. Then, what's that? It goes up, yep, it goes up and down the Shenandoah Valley. Then notice where Strasburg is. Strasburg's pretty important. Winchester, then Martinsburg. I know the story talks about that. And something really important in Strasburg. Notice that the railroad that goes east from Strasburg is the Manassas Gap Railroad, and it passes through Front Royal. And that's one of the things that made Front Royal so important. And then it flows through the Blue Ridge Mountains at the Manassas Gap. Okay, then on the smaller map, and we'll get into the story here in just a second, but I want you all to see and understand so you can follow this from the very beginning. Look on the smaller map, and this is of the village of Port Republic itself. And this is one that I drew, years and years ago. Notice the South River is flowing from the bottom to the top, and then there's the North River, and there's the one bridge there across the North River. That's the other bridge. There are two fords across the South River, an upper ford and a lower ford. And again, it's the upper ford because it's upriver, and it's the lower ford because it's downriver. And then at the very bottom of the map, you'll notice the Kemper Estate. And at the top of the map, across the bridge, that's where the infantry in Jackson's army was posted. So I think with all of those things, you'll be able to follow what's happening. I love to start off with quotes sometimes, and this is a really great one. The advance of General James Shields did enter Port Republic and came near capturing General Jackson. There are several versions of his escape, but all agree that it was by the merest chance. The surprise attack on the morning of Sunday, June 8, 1862, was completely uncharacteristic of the Federal cavalry. Decisive and swift, the 150 Union horsemen under Colonel Samuel Sprigg Carroll splashed across the South River, scattering the Confederate pickets, and stormed into the little town of Port Republic. To their immediate right, to the north, sat the wooden bridge over the North River, the main branch of the South Fork of the Shenandoah. And on the heights above that span were several brigades of General T.J. Stonewall Jackson's Valley Army. To their left, southwestward, at the end of the village's seven-block main thoroughfare, was the Kemper Estate. At that moment, General Jackson's headquarters, encamped just beyond, lay Jackson's entire baggage and ammunition train. The time was between 8 and 9 a.m. The day was already warm. Jackson and most of his staff were gathered in the lawn of the Kemper place, awaiting their horses. Two late sleepers, however, were still inside, Lieutenant Edward Willis and Colonel Stapleton Crutchfield, Jackson's recently appointed Chief of Artillery. Crutchfield and Jackson were well acquainted. Crutchfield had graduated from the Virginia Military Institute, where Jackson was an instructor, in 1855, and had remained at the Institute another 6 years as assistant professor of mathematics. Suddenly, there are a lot of direct quotes in here, so I know this is going to sound different than a lot of my presentations. These quotes are from memoirs from men who are actually there, so more than likely, they're fairly close. Suddenly, a Southern rider, hooves pounding, galloped up to Stonewall with startling news. "General," he shouted frantically, having bypassed the formality of a salute, "Federals have crossed into Port Republic, cavalry and artillery." Now, the importance of this is the fact that Jackson is separated from his entire army at this moment by those Federals in Port Republic. So think about that for just a moment. What was General Jackson's response? "We'll go back and fight them." Sounds so perfectly like him. With those prophetic words, firing erupted somewhere to the northeast. It was impossible to ascertain where. Anxious over the outcome of this unusual example of enemy activity, Jackson, without waiting for his horse or his escort, set off rapidly on foot toward the combat. The half dozen members of his staff streamed along behind. Alerted by the firing, Crutchfield fumbled with the last buttons on his frock coat as he exited the Kemper home, bounded across the front porch and into the lawn. But it was empty. Using long strides, General Jackson tramped to the head of Main Street and stopped. He blinked. There, but a few blocks away, several dozen enemy riders, the Federal advance, sat their horses amid a buzz of confusion and miniballs. One was barking orders as a knot of horsemen fired their carbines down an alley. Another cavalryman with pistol drawn was cantering along the street, eyes darting from side to side. Jackson's staff, sensing the closeness of the firing, rushed to his side. Many times they had faced the enemy, never before this close. Had the cavalryman seen Stonewall Jackson? Had the enemy cavalryman seen him? Would they rush him? Would this be the termination of his whirlwind Valley campaign, gobbled up by a platoon of blue-clad cavalry while separated from his own forces? Certainly, it was a possibility. In but a moment, a servant appeared with Stonewall's horse. He quickly mounted and, to the staff's utter chagrin, dashed northward toward the bridge. To avoid the enemy raiders, now completely filling Main Street, however, Jackson rode hard to the left around the west end of the village. Several of his staff contrived to follow, wrote celebrated Southern historian Douglas Southall Freeman, but Colonel Crutchfield and Lieutenant Willis, who were behind the others, fell into the hands of the blue troopers. That's how close this thing was. Jackson sets off, the staff sets off after him, and the two guys who'd been left behind in the house and got their horses late, both got captured by the enemy. Nabbed by a pair of northern outriders as he attempted to escape on his horse, Crutchfield was ordered at gunpoint down Main Street and presented to Colonel Carroll. In disgust, you can imagine how that felt. In disgust, the 26-year-old Confederate staff officer surrendered his sword. The Union colonel told him to remain mounted and placed him under the care of a single horseman nearby. Then the Northerner returned to the task of forming his men in the street. Wherever these enemies were going next, thought Crutchfield, they evidently planned to do so in force. Crutchfield must have certainly been appalled when, just seconds later, now this conversation that you're about to hear is according to Crutchfield. Seconds later, a northern cavalryman rode up with a wide-eyed look. "Colonel," he shouted above the noise of sporadic firing, "you've got Jackson's entire wagon train." "Where is it?" Colonel Carroll shot back. "Just up yonder," he replied, pointing down Main Street. "You can see the whole thing in the fields of that old farm. There must be hundreds of wagons and no graybacks to defend them." The federal officer jerked his head to the side and shot an inquisitive look at Crutchfield. "Is that right, Colonel?" he asked. "That is something you're going to have to find out for yourself," was Colonel Crutchfield's reply. He's under no obligation to give the guy information. "You, Captain," ordered the Union officer, "take your squadron up the street and see about the enemy train. Do it now." As 50 federal cavalrymen broke off and headed down Main Street, Crutchfield tried desperately to hide his apprehension. Seemingly, General Jackson was safe. Thank goodness for that. But what a prize was just a gallop away. The loss of the Army's baggage would be a bad enough defeat for one day. But without the reserve ammunition, the Confederate Army would be forced to retreat, maybe even give up the Shenandoah Valley. All that remained between these aggressive Union horsemen and that prize catch was perhaps a picket guard of Southern infantrymen, picket guard, just a few dozen men at most, and a battery of guns that had only recently been attached to the Army, a unit of men that had never before been in combat, the Charlottesville Light Artillery. The Charlottesville Artillery, also known as Captain Carrington's Company of Virginia Light Artillery, was organized on March 15, 1862, by James McDowell Carrington. This enterprising young man was well connected. He was a nephew of Virginia-born Confederate General John Buchanan Floyd, former U.S. Secretary of War, not a very good Secretary of War, by the way, and had served on his uncle's staff during an 1861 campaign in the western region of the state. Not a very good Confederate general either, by the way. He was also well-educated, having attended the University of Virginia and a brief course of military studies at the Virginia Military Institute. In early 1862, Carrington received permission to leave the front and return to Charlottesville to raise a battery of artillery. It would appear that the military life and leadership were in James Carrington's veins. He was born in 1839 in Botetourt County, Virginia, the son of General Edward Coddington. And, you know, I've looked this up a number of times and can't figure out why his name was Carrington and his father's name was Coddington. But you'll just have to believe me on this point. He was the son of General Edward Coddington, who, ironically, had died in 1857 from a wound received in the War of 1812 at the Battle of Sackett's Harbor, New York. James's maternal grandparents were General Francis Smith Preston and Sally Campbell, the daughter of Revolutionary War hero General William Campbell, who had been at the Battle of Kings's Mountain. It was perhaps for these reasons that Carrington was elected captain of the company over the heads of several West Point graduates. His election as commander of the unit surprised and alarmed him because, according to Carrington, he had hardly attained his maturity and had no experience in the artillery service and very little in the discipline of men. That a direct quote from him. So he was a little shaky about that. The battery's other elected officers included First Lieutenant James L. Dinwiddie, a 22-year-old graduate of Hampton-Sydney College who had already seen service in the infantry, Second Lieutenant John H. Timberlake, and from the same family that owns the pharmacy in downtown Charlottesville, the Timberlakes. He was a 21-year-old who Carrington described as every inch a soldier, fastidious in his dress, an elegant horseman, as brave as a lion, and as gentle as a woman. Third Lieutenant Alexander Sandy Cochran, a graduate of the VMI and UVA Law School, and Fourth Lieutenant French S. Bibb, 7 sergeants, 12 corporals, a quartermaster sergeant, a bugler, and approximately 127 privates rounded out the unit's human complement. The essence of the company was drawn from some of Charlottesville's and the university's finest. All of the commissioned officers and most of the non-coms, in fact, had pursued their studies at the University of Virginia. So this is quite an unusual unit. A lot of really well-educated individuals. Quite fittingly then, the unit was first quartered on the grounds of Mr. Jefferson's academical village while undergoing the pangs of organization and drill. It was there that the Charlottesville artillery suffered its first casualty, Robert Draper, who died of an unrecorded illness on April 10th and was buried in town. While at the university also, the ladies of Charlottesville presented the battery with uniforms that Carrington wrote were too elegant, as well as many other conveniences and luxuries which only their patriotism and thoughtfulness could suggest. Within 2 months of organizing, the battery received its materiel, its guns and equipment. These included, in late April, 4 tubes produced at the Tredegar Iron Works in Richmond, 2 3-inch ordnance rifles and 2 6-pounder smoothbores, plus, on May 15th, 2 12-pounder ironed howitzers. On the move, each cannon, and I tell you what, take a look at that second page and the bottom portion of it, the bottom one-third, shows you an artillery battery in line, and if you look just below that, you'll see some of the things that I'm about to describe. On the move, each cannon was drawn by 6 horses attached to a limber, which carried a large ammunition chest, followed by a caisson, also pulled by a team of 6, loaded with 3 more boxes of shot and shell. Thus, a 6-gun battery had 6 limbers and 6 caissons and at least 72 horses to tow them. Right. Also needed was a mobile battery forge to help make repairs in the field and several wagons to haul the company's camping and cooking gear. The Charlottesville unit, when it departed Charlottesville, Virginia, for the front, took with it 104 horses. One of the reasons I think you'll understand really quickly why artillery was so expensive to maintain in the field. Aside from all that equipment, 104 horses for 6 pieces of artillery. The organization of the Charlottesville artillery was unique in several respects. First of all, it comprised 6 cannon, while most Confederate batteries contained only 4. With 6 guns, it was very unusual, very, very unusual in the Confederate artillery. Secondly, the unit included 3 types of ammunition, 3 types of guns, a nightmare for supply officers, but an aspect that made the unit more versatile in combat. The ordnance rifles were the long-range offensive pieces, tubes fairly accurate out to about a mile, while the 6-pounders were light guns with a maximum effective range of about 1,100 or 1,200 yards. The howitzers, on the other hand, were the defensive weapons. Their big bores giving them the capacity to fire large rounds of anti-personnel canister. So let's take a look. Let's take a look at this little chart at the bottom. They did a pretty nice job. You see the gun with the limber and the six horses? You know, from the side. The reason I'm doing this is I oftentimes get questions about the artillery. And I know a lot of you know some of this, but let me just show you. The limber looks like this from the side. So this is the ammunition chest here. The six horses are out front here. So this is attached directly to the cannon. So on the move, it looks like this. Sorry about that. Sorry about the squeaks. So on the move, it looks like that. Six horses, a limber, and a gun. So it's the limber that actually maneuvers it out into battery. And that's where we get the phrase to limber is to put it up to get ready to move, and to unlimber means to put it into battery, to put the piece into battery. Then the reserve ammunition for each gun is being hauled by another limber towing a caisson. So the other limber looks exactly the same, but what it's pulling behind it is the caisson. Just like that song, the caissons go rolling along. And the caisson is a little bit larger, and it has two more ammunition chests on it. So the reserve ammunition for each piece is three more ammunition chests. And this, again, is being hauled by six horses. And yes, they could do it with four horses, and yes, sometimes they use mules, but this is the optimal, is doing it with horses. They made a couple of mistakes in here, and I just want to point these out. Under field artillery, or light artillery, and that's what we're talking about here, the Charlottesville light artillery obviously was light artillery, it lists 24-pounders as light guns. 24-pounders are not light guns. So you should scratch the 24-pounders from that list. A 24-pounder is not a light gun. That's more of a siege gun. The heavy artillery includes siege guns and siege mortars. You should put the 24-pounder under heavy artillery. The field artillery or the light artillery would be 6-pounders, 10-pounder Parrots. And when you refer to the pound, it's how much the shell, or in the case of the Parrot, the bolt, actually weighs. So a 10-pounder Parrot fires a bolt, and the bolt is longer. The bolt kind of looks like this. That weighs 10 pounds. It's not quite that big. Weighs 10 pounds. 12-pounders obviously fire a 12-pounder shell or solid shot. The 6-pounder fires a 6-pounder. Then you have guns that are measured by their bore. So, for example, the 3-inch ordnance rifle, which is also light artillery, means that the bore is 3 inches across. So the mouth of the gun, the bore, is 3 inches. The 3-inch ordnance rifle, and I think they show it to you on the right, the 3-inch ordnance rifle and the 10-pounder Parrot are the two most common pieces of rifled artillery that you see on the battlefield in the Civil War. There were 20-pounder Parrots, there were 30-pounder Parrots, there were 50-pounder Parrots, but the bigger ones are not the typical light artillery. At First Manassas, there was one, for example, at First Manassas, there was one 30-pounder Parrot, but they didn't even take it across Bull Run. So it fired on Evans's folks from across Stone Bridge on the other side. In other words, that to me proves that it's not field artillery. They didn't bother to drag it with that flanking column and take it across Bull Run at Sudley Springs. They left it where they thought it was going to be safe. It ended up getting captured anyway, but they left it at a place where they thought it was going to be safe. So those are the two most common and the two most famous rifled artillery pieces used in the Civil War, and the performance on both of them, the performance is really, really close. So they have a maximum effective range of about a mile, 1,760 yards. There are several guns in the Civil War that had a further maximum effective range, but it didn't matter because there weren't any field artillery spotters in use in the Civil War. And a large number, the vast majority of the battlefields had wooded terrain and rolling terrain. And without an field artillery spotter, it doesn't matter if the gun fires 6 miles because you have no idea where the shell is landing at the other end. So it can fire 20 miles, but if you can't tell where it's going, it doesn't make any difference. So about a mile is about as good as you want it because you can see where it hits at a mile away. You can see the effectiveness with the field glasses of what's happening with the shells that you're firing. The six-pounder is at the bottom. The Charlottesville Field Artillery had six-pounders. Later on this year, the six-pounders, in 1862, the six-pounders were taken out of the Army and melted down and turned into 12-pounder Napoleons. Why? Well, the six-pounder just fires this little thing, and there were plenty of experience, you know, a six-pound solid shot or a six-pounder shell. There were plenty of experiences in the Confederate artillery where the six-pounders would pull up and open up against 10-pounder Parrots, and there's no competition. The 10-pounder Parrot, really common in the Federal artillery, maximum effective range of about a mile. The six-pounder with an effective range of 1,100 yards, so they sit out at a distance and just pound the heck out of these little six-pounders. So what you wanted was a mix, some rifled guns, Napoleons, and maybe some howitzers. The howitzers had larger bores, and that meant they could fire larger rounds of canister, the typical anti-personnel weapon. So anybody have any ammunition? Anybody have any questions about the artillery? I just wanted to go through that quickly. Yep.
The 3-inch field gun fired a shell of what weight?
It was about 10 pounds because the capabilities of the 10-pounder Parrot and the 3-inch ordnance rifle were real similar. So it's about a 10-pounder shell. Good question. Yep.
You said that they had 50-pound howitzers?
There were 50-pound Parrots. And a good way of telling a Parrot, you can always tell a Parrot at a distance because they had that reinforcing band over the breech. So the Parrots always looked like this, with an extra reinforcing band. And they did that so that they could put a larger charge down the barrel without being afraid of this just blowing up on them. So that's the way you can tell the Parrots. Yeah, so they were 50-pounders.
How many men would it take to move the 50-pound?
Okay, it's horses. Oh, the shell.
The shell, yeah.
Probably one guy. One guy with tongs can lift 50 pounds, sure.
Okay.
We're talking about young guys, right? We're not talking about me. We're talking about young guys. Young guys, right? Any other questions about the artillery?
How long in between could they use the same gun?
In between what?
Fire it. Once they fired it, how frequently could they?
So you're asking how frequently they fired? You could fire twice with a really well-trained crew. You could fire twice a minute, but that's going to use up your ammunition really quickly. Usually you'd fire about once a minute with these pieces. These are all muzzle-loading pieces. So the ammunition and all the ammunition's being loaded down the front. Right. Good question, though. So their average rate of fire was about once a minute. Yep. Yeah, you swab them out in between every shot. You swab them out with water. But the main reason you swab it out with water is you don't want the next charge of ammunition to explode while you're loading it. And if there are any embers inside, you want to put them out with the water. Now, you're cleaning it, but you're also putting out any kinds of leftover embers, burning embers inside from that last round. That's really important because you have to actually cut a little hole in the bag when you put the bag down there. So you've got a bag of gunpowder, you cut a hole in it, you shove that down. I don't want to think that there are any burning. And by the way, she asked the question, but guys lost their hands and their arms all the time doing this because they didn't swab them out effectively. Yep.
Last night on the History Channel, they were saying that they used beluga whale and lard to lubricate the things going in.
Right.
Where would that be carried then? Some of that lard and
on some of the shells, on the some of the shells had a sabot, a base, and there'd be lard around the base. Yep. The mortars. No, the mortars are not rifled. The mortars are smooth bores. So the only ones in this little chart down here, the only two that are rifled are the 3-inch field gun, which is usually called the 3-inch ordnance rifle, and the 10-pounder Parrot. The other two on either side, the 12-pounder Napoleon and the 6-pounder, are both smooth bores. Yep. Yeah, that's a great, great question. All right, you know, the most common shell is a 12-pounder shell, common shot. Let's do shot first. And it's real easy to remember this stuff. Well, that's way too big. I was a shot putter in high school briefly, so I'm supposed to know because I threw 12-pound shot. It's maybe a little bit smaller than this, and it's solid, solid shot. What's that? 4 and a bit, 4.3 or something like 4. Right, about 4 inches across, that's right. And it's solid, solid shot. Solid shot is used to batter. So you've got a fortification, you want to knock it down. You've got a house, say you've got some sharpshooters that you're facing and they're inside of a stone structure. You want to knock down the stone structure or a wooden structure, better yet. Or any kind of frame structure, you knock it down, you batter it. You also use solid shot against massed enemy troops. So solid shot would be really good against massed cavalry or even infantry that's in a column and you're firing down the column. So massed formations, you use solid shot. One of the tactics was actually bounding the shot. And think about this for a moment, folks. This is really important. It wasn't until World War I that artillery became really, really effective with the bombardments, that a lot of, and the barrages, where a lot of casualties were caused by the artillery. In the Civil War and a few of the wars after the Civil War, the artillery, its effectiveness is mostly psychological. This thing that weighs 12 pounds is coming at you from a great distance, and it's not coming so quickly that you can't see it. You can see it coming at you. And when there's a number of them, you can see them coming at you. That's a huge psychological effect. And bounding the shot, what they would do is they would actually, a column of infantry is coming, bounce the solid shot in front of them so they can see them bouncing up to them. At First Manassas, there was a famous incident where one of the Rhode Island units was advancing and Imboden from Henry House Hill was bounding the shot in front of them. And one of the guys evidently was a bowler and thought that he could stop the solid shot with his leg. And it took his leg off. And everybody else immediately realized you can't stop a solid shot with your leg. But that's how well you can see them. You can see them coming. They're not moving all that quickly. Yeah.
How can you make them bounce?
You aim at the ground in front of the enemy at an angle so that they bounce on the ground. They're skipping on the ground. They're bouncing on the ground in front of the enemy. Bounding the... In front of the enemy, right. And hope that it doesn't bury itself. But these things, round things don't tend to bury themselves unless you hit something at an angle. They tend to bounce around. Right. Or bound, you could bound it down a road. That's a real, at a column coming down a road. That's a really good way of doing that. The grandson of Jefferson, George Wythe Randolph, did that at Big Bethel. He bounded some shot in front of the enemy along a road, and he claims it broke up their column. In other words, the guys saw it coming and went off the road on either side. Pretty effective. So that's what you use solid shot for. Then shell is a shell. It's hollow. And it has, in different times and different manufacturers, has different kinds of things inside. Sometimes they had balls inside. Sometimes they just had powder inside. If they have balls inside, it's called shrapnel. If it has powder inside, it's called a shell. And it uses an explosive timer, and the timers in the Civil War were notoriously bad. What you want the shell to do is you want to fire it over top of the enemy, and you want it to explode above the infantry or above the cavalry and rain down the shards on them. But because the timers were so badly manufactured and ineffective, it was very difficult to get it to work like you were supposed to. Yeah. Right, right. And they overshot. They overshot the federal artillery on Cemetery Ridge. Absolutely, they did. So in that case, it worked. Well, all of this. Oh, it was federal artillery and federal cavalry. Oh, okay. It worked real well from the Confederate point of view. Yeah. And then you have everybody's favorite, which is canister, which is a tin. Later on in the war, sometimes canister was just a bag. And a canister loaded into a 12-pounder howitzer or a 12-pounder Napoleon, and it's about this big, it's set to explode as soon as it comes out of the barrel. And that's what turns those things into, and I know you've heard this a million times on the History Channel, a big sawed-off shotgun. And you want to use canister from about 200 yards out to about 500 yards. And the maximum, the best range is about 300, 350 yards. Why? Because from the gun, once you fire the gun, the cluster is still fairly close once it leaves the barrel. But the further out, the more spread you get on the cluster of what's inside here. Sometimes there are mini balls. Sometimes there are other balls. Sometimes there, I mean, I've read about them using nails, anything they put inside of a bag at the end of the war could be used as canister. So this is the big anti-personnel ammunition canister. So those are the main kinds. Good question. Any other questions about the artillery? We'll get back to our story.
Why would you use something that's not rifled? I mean, the purpose of rifling is in order to increase accuracy.
Great question. That's a great question. Because the smoothbores, the 12-pounder Napoleon, has a larger bore, meaning that it's a better weapon to load your canister in. The bore is bigger than the 3-inch ordnance rifle or the 10-pounder Parrott. In fact, the bore on the 12-pounder is 4 inches across? 4 1/4 inches, meaning that the load of canister is larger, meaning that it's a better weapon anti-personnel. So ideally what you would want to do, and it wasn't done like this very often, but ideally, say you had 4 guns, you'd have 2 rifles and 2 12-pounder Napoleons. Now you've got your offensive weapons and your defensive weapons. Or you've got 2 batteries, and you've got a rifle battery unlimbered next to a smoothbore battery. Now you've got your offensive weapons and your defensive weapons. So you want to mix. But the reason you want the smoothbores, the big ones, the 12-pounder or a 12-pounder howitzer, is for a defensive weapon. Because those guys are going to come after you, and the artillery can't stand anywhere by itself. It has to have infantry alongside of it. And if you're there by yourself, they're going to figure out how to get you. Because that's a prize. That's one of the prizes on the battlefields, a piece of artillery or an enemy banner, an enemy flag, but especially a piece of artillery. Any other questions? We'll get back to the Charlottesville artillery. Charlottesville artillery received its first marching orders May 15, 1862. 2 days later, despite the fact, as Wilbur Davis wrote, the whole town was agog, and we found it hard to get off. The unit took to the road, headed for the Shenandoah Valley. The battery in motion surely presented quite a scene. Carrington and Dinwiddie out front, their horses prancing, followed by the rumbling limbers and caissons with riders on the wheel horses and gunners sitting on each ammunition chest, holding on for dear life. That's another thing I forgot to add. That's how they moved. The gunners are sitting on the ammunition chests. So think about that. And just hoping that none of that ammunition explodes while they're sitting on it. As the last battery wagon rolled by, a citizen with a head for mathematics could have calculated that the unit took up over 250 yards of road. 6 pieces of artillery with all the equipment, 250 yards of road. They departed on the main road leading north to Earlysville. And but a few days later, Carrington's men passed through Stannardsville, Wolfton, and Madison Courthouse. On May 22nd, the unit traversed the Blue Ridge Mountains at Milam's Gap and continued downhill toward Luray. So Luray is on the map, right in the middle of the Luray Valley there, or the Page Valley, and you can follow their trip now. On the 26th of May, they rolled through Winchester and into the Confederate camp near Bunker Hill on the road toward Harper's Ferry. There, Captain Carrington reported to General Richard Dick Ewell, Jackson's second in command, and received an unofficial assignment as Brigade Battery to Brigadier General Richard Taylor's Louisiana Brigade. Taylor was the Harvard and Yale educated son of President Zachary Taylor, and also the brother-in-law to Jeff Davis. And there, Carrington learned that he had rushed his unit down the valley all in vain. Stonewall Jackson, in a brilliant campaign full of lightning marches and sucker punches, had finally reached the northernmost section of the Shenandoah Valley and was about to commence a very rapid skedaddle. Northern armies were beginning to close in on three sides, and it was high time to head up the valley back towards Stanton. Let's look at this map really quickly, and I'm taking up a lot more time than I thought I was going to, so we're going to do this really quickly. So you can understand what had happened in the Valley Campaign. The Battle of Front Royal, where we went just last month, was fought on May 23rd, 1862. Front Royal just to the east of Strasburg. Banks, with 8,000 men, was at Strasburg. He posted about 1,100 at Front Royal. Jackson, with about 17,000, completely destroyed the Union force at Front Royal. Out of those 1,100, 950 were killed, wounded, or captured. At that point, Banks was outflanked and outnumbered. He had intended to dig in at Strasburg, and he started backpedaling towards Winchester. Astride Banks' rail connection to Washington, Jackson advanced against Winchester, and Banks conducted an all-night retreat. Actually got to Winchester, but lost a lot of stuff along the way. The Battle of Winchester was fought on May 25th. It was another Confederate victory. Banks retreated to Martinsburg, so he goes from Winchester to Martinsburg, and crossed the Potomac on May 26th. So by this time, in the Shenandoah Valley Campaign, Stonewall Jackson, and one of the reasons it's so brilliant, had completely cleared the Shenandoah Valley of the enemy presence. By May 29th, Jackson was concentrated at Halltown, and that's 3 miles west of Harper's Ferry. And it looks to me like it's approximately where that road and that railroad to Harper's Ferry cross. You see that? Okay, thanks to all of these moves and thanks to all these Confederate victories in the Shenandoah Valley Campaign, Washington, the Lincoln administration, you can just imagine, was completely thrown into a panic. And out of nowhere, Lincoln and the Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, decide that they're going to start managing the military affairs in the Shenandoah Valley personally. So McDowell had about 40,000 men at Fredericksburg, at Manassas, rather. He was ordered to march to the west to converge on Strasburg along the route of the Manassas Gap Railroad. Okay? Fremont was close to Moorefield. He was ordered to march to the east to converge on Strasburg. And another federal force under Banks and an officer by the name of Saxton, they were organized in Maryland and ordered to advance on Jackson that way. In other words, they were going to converge on his force from three sides and hopefully trap him in the northern Shenandoah Valley. So Jackson, on May 30th, hears about all these people coming his way and starts to force march to the rear. And by the narrowest of margins, he escaped the trap with his entire force. So he passed through the pincers at Strasburg with 15,000 men, 2,000 prisoners, about half of those are people he had captured at Front Royal. And listen to this, a double wagon train. In other words, the road had two lines of wagons that was 7 miles long. That is one heck of a wagon train. Federal troops had failed. They'd failed to trap him. And more importantly, 40,000 men under McDowell had been withheld from McClellan. McDowell had been ordered to participate with McClellan, to cooperate with McClellan against Richmond. Now, because of what Stonewall Jackson had done in the Shenandoah Valley, McDowell was completely taken off the board vis-a-vis McClellan's Peninsula campaign. Okay, let's get back to the Charlottesville artillery. Now a part of Jackson's Valley Army of approximately 16,000 men, the Charlottesville artillery retreated through Strasburg on May 31st and continued on south through Edinburgh and Mount Jackson. Although supposedly attached to Taylor's brigade, the unit's place in the order of march was among the wagons of the baggage and reserve ammunition train. They were new to the army, but the Charlottesville boys must have quickly realized that they had not been given a position of trust or a position of honor. During this march, however, two of Carrington's men had a brief brush with old Stonewall himself. On a night of heavy rain, battery member Leroy Cox and another private took shelter on the front porch of a cottage. While asleep, and this is from the memoirs of Leroy Cox, while asleep, General Jackson and his staff came up and camped on the same porch, Cox remembered. We later learned that some of his staff wanted to move us, but he said, no, let them stay here. And the next sentence gives you an idea of how much the men revered somebody like Stonewall Jackson, because it doesn't seem like a big deal, but this was a really big deal to these guys. No, let them stay here. When we woke up the next morning, I found to my surprise that I had some of General Jackson's cover on me. In other words, it so amazed this guy that part of Jackson's blanket was over top of him. On June 5th, the artillery unit marched through Harrisonburg and 4 miles beyond on the road stretching to the southeast. 2 days later, still accompanying the baggage and ordnance wagons, the Charlottesville artillery crossed the North River Bridge into the sleepy village of Port Republic. Passing through town, they continued into the fields of the Kemper estate and set up camp in a low spot behind the house. With the tents pitched, several of the men took advantage of the pleasant June afternoon by bathing in the adjacent South River. Others visited nearby Weir's Cave. So they already knew of Weir's Cave, and Confederates were acting like tourists. Port Republic was an important strategic location for Stonewall Jackson. His two closest antagonists at this point in time, Union Generals John Charles Fremont with 11,000, 12,000 men, and James Shields with another 3,000 to 5,000, were pursuing him up the Shenandoah on either side of Massanutten. Fremont's force was advancing along the main section of the valley to the west of Massanutten, while Shields, with an aggressive force of cavalry out front, was feeling his way southwest into the Luray Valley to Massanutten's east. From his position at Port Republic, well beyond the southwestern edge of Massanutten, Jackson could lash out at whichever enemy force approached first. And that's why he took up a position there. He's going to hit whichever one pops out of their part of the valley first. But the placement of his troops at Port Republic on the morning of June 8th was extremely flawed. Perhaps his normally efficient staff, overtaxed by the extreme rigors of the campaign, had simply let down their guard. Jackson's infantry force had been allowed to encamp north of the North River, across the bridge from town. While the Army's precious ammunition and baggage train, what kept the soldiers fed and fighting, was parked southwest of Port Republic, only a minimal force was in between, guarding the two fords of the South River. A troop of cavalrymen under Captain J.J. Chipley lounged along the left bank at the lower ford. A 25-man detachment from Company I, 2nd Virginia Infantry, under Captain Samuel J.C. Moore, was more vigilantly, watching the upper ford at the other end of Port Republic. So just a handful of guys in between. Sunday, June 8th, dawned warm and peaceful. The men of Jackson's Valley Army were looking forward to the morning's church services as well as a desperately needed day of rest. It was not to be. Captain James Carrington's first intimation of the enemy's proximity came from Quartermaster Sergeant Charles Harmon, who rode into camp shouting that the Yankees had taken the town. A quick glance over to the Kemper house, where Jackson and his staff were talking quietly, convinced him that the pronouncement was false. In other words, he hears this guy screaming, he looks over, and Jackson's just standing there So it must not be true. But a moment later, all hell broke loose. Shots rang out from the town, and Carrington could see Stonewall rushing over to investigate. Just then, wrote Carrington, some Southern cavalrymen reached the fence around Kemper's yard where the nearest street turns at right angles. And you see where he's talking about? Where the street turns at right angles just in front of the Kemper house. Oh, here we go. I'm always afraid of that. Where the street turns at right angles into the Stanton Road, and some Confederate officer had the presence of mind to ride by me and in a loud voice halloo, "Bring up the artillery." The artillery captain ordered his bugle to sound the alarm, his bugler. In response to this, continued Carrington, we rolled by hand one piece in sight so as to command the road from the angle. Near us were a few infantrymen, probably some of Moore's infantrymen, in addition, a few of Chipley's cavalrymen, with enemy troopers right on their heels, rushed down Main Street and into the open field alongside Jackson's headquarters. Seeing Carrington's boys preparing a defense, these Southern horsemen halted briefly and fired into the onrushing Federal skirmishers. Meanwhile, in town, the bulk of the enemy cavalry was preparing to attack. In the flush of excitement, most of the battery's cannon were hitched up and ordered to the rear down the road toward Waynesboro. Private Leroy Cox, however, remembered how one gun was brought back to Kemper's. In other words, another gun. They rolled one over, and then another one was brought back. It was a scene that Cox, without a doubt, greatly embellished. So here's this scene as Cox remembered it many years later. Rushing up to Lieutenant Timberlake, Cox claimed that he pleaded, "For God's sake, don't let us run without firing a shot." Timberlake was mounted, Cox wrote, and looked more a general than a lieutenant. His eyes lit up as only a gallant soldier's will. He at once drew his sword and said, "I will stand with my two pieces, even if they are captured." According to Cox, the lieutenant chased after one of the pieces, sword in hand, and ordered it into position on the Kemper lawn. So now there are two pieces of the Charlottesville artillery there. But a few blocks away on Main Street, Union Colonel Carroll finally decided he'd had enough skirmishing. It was time for a bold thrust. The Federals formed confidently in the street and started at a slow trot toward the Kemper house. Crutchfield, still being held a prisoner, could only watch in mute misery. As the Blue Horsemen rounded the turn at the head of the street, they were unexpectedly greeted by a brisk rifle fire. So that's the few infantrymen under Moore who were alongside the Charlottesville artillery cannon. Bullets zipped overhead and underfoot. Some slammed into the buildings. The Northern cavalrymen recoiled and dashed back into the safety of the town. So the first attack is tossed back. Riding among them, Colonel Carroll demanded that they halt and reform. He was not about to lose this huge opportunity, the capture of the baggage and the reserve ammunition. Carrington sensed that the enemy would try their luck again, but at the moment, he was in a quandary. The question, he later wrote, was whether we should open on them with canister. We were afraid that Jackson and his staff had been captured and were with this cavalry unit and might be killed. Certainly an honest concern, not wishing to slaughter your commanding general. However, the time for questioning was over. Looking across the Kemper yard, Carrington could see the enemy coming at them again. We hesitated, he wrote, but then the order was given by the Yankee colonel to charge. In other words, he was close enough that he could hear Carroll ordering his men to charge. And hearing this, the Charlottesville artillery opened on them, aided by Moore's infantry. With the Federal horsemen filling the sights, the Charlottesville boys worked their pieces like demons. On one gun they loaded, and yanking the lanyard, fired so quickly that they neglected to properly elevate the barrel. On its discharge, the cannon blasted through the fence in their immediate front, sending splinters and fragments of wood along the way. The shot still proved effective, however, and the enemy again halted their advance. Viciously, the two guns continued to bark. This according to Douglas Southall Freeman. The Federal troopers galloped off the street. In the alleys and behind the houses, the bluecoats gathered. nor would their Colonel Carroll induce them, nor could their Colonel Carroll induce them to face a fire that swept the street from end to end. Confederate Staff Officer Crutchfield, according to Freeman, straightened himself in his saddle and scarcely could believe that the Charlottesville artillery had fired into the head of the Federal column. Could it be that the ordnance train was safe? For the moment, yes. But suddenly the action shifted to the span over the North Bridge on the northern edge of town. And oddly enough, Carrington's battery played a role there too, even though they were not present. Jackson had galloped across the bridge just as the Federals were closing in behind him, wrote Freeman. No sooner was he on the ridge than he hurried to the nearest batteries and ordered three of them to open fire. Two infantry brigades were also ordered forward to clear Port Republic of the enemy cavalry. While standing on the steep ridge, watching for his infantry to advance, Jackson spied a single gun being rolled toward the southern edge of the bridge, so in town. Turning to the closest artillerymen, Jackson gave them the command to open fire on that one gun. "But General," shouted the gunners, "those are our men." "Fire on that cannon," General Jackson repeated. "General," answered the battery captain, "I'm certain those are our men. A new unit from Charlottesville has recently joined the army and they're uniformed just like those fellows down there manning that piece." Seemingly convinced, Jackson rode forward a ways and shouted at the cannoneers across the river, "Bring that gun up here." Not getting an acknowledgement, he repeated, "Bring that gun up here, I say." The soldiers at the other end of the bridge moved this time, this according to Freeman, but it was not to cross the bridge. Instead, they dropped the trail of the piece and began loading it. The Confederate artillery opened fire on the bold Federal gunners, but because of the altitude difference, were unable to depress their muzzles sufficiently in order to drive them away. Fortunately, however, the lead regiment from General William Booth Tolliver's brigade, the 37th Virginia Infantry, and you see their attack on the map, soon double-quicked to Jackson's assistance. With Stonewall watching, the regiment rushed down from the heights, charged across the bridge, and chased the Union soldiers from their gun. That accomplished, they continued on into the village, driving Carroll's cavalrymen across the upper ford and to the great relief of General Jackson, finally securing Port Republic. In the confusion of those last few moments, Crutchfield and Willis evaded their captors and rode away free men. So the two staff officers that had been captured got away. It had been, as the soldiers used to say, a near-run thing. Jackson and his staff had barely escaped capture and imprisonment, and the Army's ordnance and baggage train had just as luckily eluded destruction. Much of the credit for snatching victory from the jaws of defeat went to Carrington and the brave boys from Charlottesville. James McDowell Carrington and Lieutenant Timberlake, wrote Freeman, had displayed rare judgment. And amazingly, the action had cost them only one man wounded, Henry Clay Page, who was discharged several weeks later. By contrast, the head of Main Street was littered with 14 dead Federal horses. No doubt, the Charlottesville artillery's close-range canister blast had also wounded several of Carroll's troopers. Private Leroy Cox noted with glee that after the fight, General Jackson came up and said, and this is a direct quote, came up and said, "When he saw where we had shot canister through the plank fence, if it was a lot of green men, they certainly seemed to know how to use canister." There were many years of war yet to go, but the men and boys of the Charlottesville artillery would always remember the morning of June 8, 1862, the morning they saved Stonewall's bacon. Thanks.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.